The WBAI Community Advisory Board is planning to meet in open forum. All members are invited to this town hall meeting at the Wall Street Atrium, easily accessible by public transportation. The meeting is at 1 p.m. on June 28th, 2015. That is at the Wall Street Atrium, a CAB meeting. All are invited, June 28th, 2015.
The earth will lie in the power of our youth when we no longer can. How do we understand and help our urban children resolve the current issues that they deal with? First, we must listen to them. BRIC brings to you its Youth Be Heard, Fighting for a Voice community town hall event. WBAI is broadcasting this event in partnership with BRIC, live Wednesday, June 17th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's located at the BRIC House, which is in downtown Brooklyn at 647 Fulton Street. There will be panelists, as well as youth leader panelists, discussing the underlying problems that the urban youth face. For more information, you can visit BRICArtsMedia.org. That's B-R-I-C, artsmedia.org.
the perfect thing for him because he describes the focus of his work as advocacy journalism. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And the woman next to Juan is Ms. Nadia Lopez. She's the founding principal at the Mott Hall Bridges Academy in Brownsville. Thank you so much for being here. You might recognize her as the million-dollar principal from the Humans of New York, but we've known that she's worth much more than that for a long time in this building, and we'll definitely get into that later.
Thank you.
Next to Principal Lopez is Ibro Darden. He is one-third of the Hot 97 morning team and a radio professional whose career has brought him all over the country, and we welcome here tonight. Thanks for being here. And Yaritza is next to me. She is representing the Make the Road organization. She's a youth organizer there, and she does a lot of work around youth organizing, particularly about punitive systems of
television. If we don't behave that way on our social media platforms, they don't put that stuff on television. If we don't click on those websites, it doesn't sell advertising and it doesn't exist. So there is, we talked about it on the radio that morning.
Yes.
We talked about her emotional problems. We talked about the behavioral issues.
Thank you.
SOS. Again, that's Youth Organizing for Save Our Streets. We're the young people featured in there. And we thank them again for being such great partners and being so open. And looking at that picture right there, specific to this place where we live and so incredibly universal at the same time. Those were kids from anywhere in the world with the same aspirations, but maybe not the same set of expectations set in front of them by a broader world. So Marlon, I'm going to go to you and you, Yurtza, right now to talk about where our young people are in terms of what they think they can achieve.
Well, you know, first of all, definitely I give a shout out to Yo SOS as a program. I got to make some noise. I was blessed to play a role in starting that program some years ago, just about 10 months after, a little over a year after I was released from prison. And to see it still happening now makes me proud to see these young folks doing that. Interesting enough, that question, I'm looking at that park. That's the park I grew up in. That's my park, Broward Park, BCM as we call it. And an interesting juxtaposition about it is that in that particular park, a lot of good happened in that park and a lot of not so good happened in that park. But when we have an opportunity to have a conversation with them, right, when we say, let's have a conversation with these young folks in the space that a lot of folks in our community don't feel comfortable talking to them in the park. My man in the video had his pants sagging. So automatically, there's a demographic of us in this room and who's watching us on television that's not going to talk to that young man, right? But interesting enough, he has a lot to say. But we don't get to hear it, so we usually push him to the side or her to the side, thinking that they will do something to me. In that, what we're doing, not only are we quieting their voices, but, you know, fortunately, these folks have people in their lives who can mentor them, who can support them. They're in a program where they get to associate with people who give them a productive sort of experience and exposure to different experiences. Everybody doesn't have that. So when we sort of push them away and we automatically judge him or her because she looks a certain way or he uses that sort of language, we can be actually pushing that young person into a situation that can cause more harm to himself and our community. And I said in that park,
all right. Right now, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. You're listening to a community town hall meeting called Youth Be Heard, Fighting for a Voice. It's a collaboration with BRIC, Brooklyn Arts Media. And we're listening to it right now. And it's broadcasting live here on WBAI.
To try and end it. There's no like one quick fix for any city or wherever you are, right? It's hard. I actually went to two different high schools growing up myself. So I went to a school that actually had a lot of resources in the city. And then I went to a neighborhood school in the neighborhood that was over policed, had metal. I'm going to get hurt in this school. Like when you look at a building, you already have all these assumptions based on the way that it looks because it doesn't look like a school anymore. There's gates, there's bars on the windows. That's not an educational environment at all. Like, what are you saying, right? Like, if I had this impression as a young person, imagine if you're older, if you're a teacher and you're not from the community, which a lot of teachers who are coming who are teaching in our schools are not from the neighborhood, right, who already may have, like, don't even know that they may have these implicit biases and may not understand that they may act on those things now just because of now the way the school looks. Then you go inside. You're a young person. The first thing you don't want to deal with, right, is like a school safety agent yelling in your face, which is what happens all the time. Students have to take off their shoes. Mm-hmm. Students have to take off their belts. Students have to take off all their clothes. If you have hairpins in your hair, you have to take them all out. Young people are like, get late to class. Some young people don't even make it into class until second, third period because the lines are so long. And it depends on how many openings you have at your school. And if you're at the school that I work with, which is four small schools and a huge campus, it's even more students that you're dealing with, right? It's intense. And these are agents who are not trained to deal with young people. They are literally trained by the NYPD to deal with criminals, right? And so, right, they're trained to deal with criminals. And so now you have these folks who are coming into the school who are parents I have seen get yelled at and harassed by these same agents. I've had college people who are like, we're never coming back to this school because the way they treated us was absolutely ridiculous and it was very dehumanizing.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a prison. This is not the airport. This is a school where we come to teach, where young people should feel like they are trusted, that they are respected, that they're going to be treated with dignity, mm-hmm. right? And that they have that. And when you walk into an environment like that, and then to top it on, like you can get suspended for anything. I had a classmate It was so funny looking back, but it was just so messed up why he got suspended. It's a funny story. He needed to fart. And he was like, mister, I got to go to the bathroom.
It happens.
And he like was like, mister, let me go to the restroom. You know, I don't want to break free in class. And he like went outside in the hallway, went to the bathroom. The teacher was like, no. And he was just like, okay. Went to the bathroom anyway, came back, sat in class, started doing work again. And the teacher was like, go to the office. You're getting suspended. And I was just like, I had another student come to me and said, I got suspended for talking back to my teacher, for saying no.
Yeah.
Which are all minor infractions that you're not supposed to be even getting suspended for. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that you can suspend a child for up to 45 days. I had a young woman who I had to spend all 60 days trying to figure out how to keep her encouraged at her suspension school so she could come back to school,
yeah,
because it was actually an illegal suspension.
So
her parent didn't, you know, like the process is even messed
right
up. So like 5 days turns into 45, turns into 60. Young people can be suspended for up to a year. That's an expulsion.
Yeah. So Principal Lopez, how do you weigh safety concerns with making an environment that is beneficial to your scholars against the reality of what's waiting for them outside the doors of your school?
You set the example. I set the example and expectations with my adults. My adults can't speak to my scholars. Like, that's our school. It's not my school, it's our school. So from the time you walk into my building, you get on our floor, because we are a co-located school. I don't have those issues with safety officers. My safety officers are really nice. They allow, you know, they sign you in, you come upstairs on the floor. If anybody sees you in the hallway, whether it's a scholar or any adult that works for me, first thing they say is, hi, can I help you? Do you need to get to the office? I don't tolerate adults speaking to anyone mm-hmm. in a demeaning manner, because then you don't need to be there.
Yeah.
You have options and choices, and that's mm-hmm. how I feel. When it comes to safety officers, they have to report to someone. Mm-hmm. In my building, we get to speak to NYPD. We get to have meetings. If I feel like someone is being disrespectful, we need to have that conversation, because I'm not tolerating it. And I'm going to make their life difficult just as much as they're making someone else's life difficult. So on that end, there's a lot of respect that happens in the building, but I had to fight for it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy. You know, I was a new kid on the block. I look young, so they wanted to test me. Mm-hmm. But part of it is, you have to show people and set standards that says, you're not going to speak to me or anybody who works for me like that. You're not going to speak to these children like that, especially young children, young people, right? They're just always looked upon as though they don't know any better.
Yeah.
And they're spoken to in a manner like, you don't have rights. Mm-hmm. So you don't have a right to say anything back. It's about listening first and allowing them the opportunity to engage in a conversation. When you don't establish that in your building, everybody else is running the show.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things that I'm hearing that you're saying, my question starts to come to mind, like, so where's the principal at?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? Because that wouldn't happen. As soon as someone comes to my building and they feel like someone has done them wrong, the first thing they say to me is, so I have a concern, because they know I'm going to address it.
So I'm going to Juan, I'm looking at you, listening to the young people talk about the weight of low expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that we've seen explode in other places very recently. What's the sense that you get from young people when you are in Baltimore, when you are in Ferguson about...
Well, see, I don't think they have low expectations.
No, not that they have low expectations.
Well, I mean, the media, someone mentioned earlier that how they have low expectations. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from St. Louis, like West St. Louis, a neighborhood very similar to Brownsville or Flatbush. And everyone I know, everyone I grew up with, the people that I interview, whether they be in Ferguson or whether they be in Baltimore, the young people, like I did at one point in my life when I was younger, they desire something more.
Yeah.
I think when you say they have low expectations, that's a low expectations game. Those are like the expectations of soft bigotry and saying that people have low. They don't have damn low expectations. They want all the same things that we have. They want a job. They want an education. They want a home. They want to be able to live and to be free from police harassment, to be free from the intra-violence. This morning, I wrote a story on this girl named Arnisha Bowers. A lot of people may not know her name, but at the same time, we were focused on Rachel Dozel, the white woman who was pretending to be black, a beautiful 16-year-old black girl. And this is a trigger warning for people in the audience. She was raped. She was tortured. They strangled her and they set her body on fire. And the media and the society in general, including many of us who are black and brown, were obsessed about Rachel Dozel. But Anisha's Bauer's name didn't get mentioned. She was buried last week, and I interviewed her grandmother this morning. And the pain in this woman's voice as I spoke to her for the story that I published earlier this afternoon, I wouldn't wish that upon my worst enemy. And there's no focus on that because Anisha Bauer is also a straight-A student who had plans to go to college. And she was only 16 when she was murdered by these two purported gangsters in Baltimore. There is no low expectations among black and brown youth. When people say that, they ought to check themselves and think about that. These kids want the same goddamn thing that everyone else across this country want. Mm-hmm. And it's our job as adults in society and in the media and radio and in the high school or whatever to make sure that they recognize that and that we're there to guide them as they seek to advance in society. And we should focus on people like Anisha Bowers instead of this trifling, trivial crap like Rachel Dozel out in Spokane, Washington. Mm-hmm.
So just looking at the larger picture and hearing what the young people are saying are their issues, how do you think those things manifest on a show or a network like yours where you have to synthesize all of that and give entertainment as well?
I mean, we try to have fun. I don't think we take the information as it comes. Mm-hmm. I don't think we try to synthesize anything. I could say that, you know, I'm happy with where music is today. There's obviously some content that I would prefer that we, you know, kids weren't into, but there's tons of great things like the J. Cole's and the Childish Gambino's and Kendrick Lamar. I think it's a testament to young people wanting, as you said, wanting more, mm-hmm. wanting better ideas, wanting better content. You know, if you look at a lot of the hit songs, I think some are over-sexualized, but I do think that, you know, there's a lot of a balance out there with love and aspirational things that are happening in music. So, and then as far as the content of just the news cycle of the day, you know, I can be very critical of the tabloid things myself, but it also is very popular. So we try to, obviously they call me the old man because I'm grumpy about a lot of things, and I have high expectations for young people because most of the young people that I hear from, like you said, they dream. Yeah. They want to have fun. They want, you know, support. They want love. They want to be, they want feedback. If it's an artist that, you know, wants to hear about us, they just want to learn. They want access. And they want to know that, you know, if they put in their work, there's some reward at the end of at the work that they do. And I think most people, young people, want to work hard.
Marlon, you wanted to get in?
Yeah, I think, you know, listening to Juan, what's new about what happened in terms of, you didn't even mention Khalif Browder, right? Who was a suicide, but in many cases, we're all responsible for that young man's death, right? But what's new about that? What's new about the Anaya Ferguson case and the way we sensationalize it in the news? In that video that you saw, one of the young women said, you know, they only care about it now. We've been experiencing these sort of things for generations, mm-hmm. right? When we've been experiencing our young folks not being listened to. We've been experiencing us being oppressed in terms of our mentality of lessness. Mm-hmm. Somebody called it, you know, mentioned as white supremacy. But we internalize our own helplessness and hopelessness. And in many cases, what we do, the way we deal with it, we act like a surprise when something happens, when some young brother or young woman shoots somebody on the block. We act like, oh my God, what happened? How could that possibly happen? We act surprised if we weren't to see these things happening. But then we also are complicit in many ways in how things continue. So, you know, I wrote a piece last week in Ebony speaking about the Khalif Browder case. And in it, I spoke about that, well, we knew, first of all, Khalif Browder himself, a college student, wrote about solitary confinement as effects of it. We, as a society, we incentivize politicians who come with things like tough on crime policies. New York and North Carolina, two states in the union that still prosecute young people as adults, right? And we act like young people that are 16 and 17 year olds. We are part of it. We vote these people into office. We are part of it in many cases. So as we are, and I'm very big about also holding the media responsible. I often say the media is like the fourth branch of government, but has no checks and balances. But I'm also critical about how we as a people in our own community aren't critical enough of what we see. When we see a young person on the news who are accused of a crime, the first thing many of us often say is like, he need to go to jail.
Yeah.
We say that. We don't ask the different questions. Why did that person do that? Right. What's happened in that young person's life that would cause her or him to make that decision? Right? We don't ask that question. We jump at the end and think that somehow we're going to prevent it. We are so complicit in these sort of things. So at the outset, when I said that we're finally getting it mm-hmm. by speaking to young people, hopefully there's some sort of shift. Just to add on, my experience is somebody who spent 10 years of his life in prison, right? I'm only 5 years out, and I've been able to be a part of some amazing things since I've been home. But I was also a young person in that same park, engaged in a lot of them same activities,
yeah.
who was sort of, many cases, reaching out and screaming out for some sort of, like, assistance to hear me out. So was it surprising that at 19 I caught myself in an armed robbery? Mm. I'm just saying that we have to pay more than the usual attention to what young people are saying now and check our own sort of bias at the door.
Can I interject just for one moment and then you can go?
Yeah, absolutely. But before you do that, I'm giving you guys... I'm giving you guys a 2-minute warning that we're coming to you very soon, so get yourselves ready. But back to you, Juan.
Oh, okay. Thank you. There is this role that the media plays. There's this great book called Cut the Race Beat that was published, I think, in 2007. It's about two journalists who played a significant role in the civil rights and human rights movement in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But we, as black and brown people, have to check our own biases and whatnot at the door, of course.
Yeah.
But it also depends on what the media shows you. Mm-hmm. The same time that Anaya Ferguson and Ariana Taylor were brawling in Flatbush, that same week, there was a gang of white men in mm-hmm. Midtown, St. Patrick's Day, mm-hmm. who were brawling and fighting. Yeah, and one of the white men fell down, and the white cat came up to him and kicked him in the head. The exact same thing that happened and Flatbush.
Yeah.
You did not see that on the cover. You did not see them calling these white men brutes and savages and yeah. animals. You didn't see that. So we can internalize it and look at these issues from our own perspective and, of course, check our own biases and whatever about black and brown people. But the media plays a significant role in
okay.
what we absorb as a society.
I think we can all agree to agree on that and
good.
Say, okay,
yes.
if we acknowledge that fact, let's take it a step further and say, when a St. Patrick's Day thing gets out of hand, it's not necessarily a brawl, but like two guys got a little happy.
Oh, it was a brawl, though. There were seven men fighting in the Midtown on Fifth Avenue.
Just take the walk with me for 2 minutes. If two guys leave a Midtown bar on St. Patrick's Day and things get a little out of hand and someone winds up getting kicked in the head, he's not like a brute or a savage, but
uh-huh.
this could happen to a young woman in a McDonald's somewhere. So I'm saying, how do we move forward and reframe the argument so Clive and Bundy and his gang of guys out in Nevada with their guns challenging the federal government mm. is seen as the thug and not the young man playing basketball with his yeah. pants sagging?
How or the biker we, gang, the biker
or the
gang,
biker gang
biker
in Waco,
in Dallas,
where
Texas.
Nine people are dead yes. following a biker brawl. Those people are not seen as thugs and criminals. They're a gang, or they're the 19 individuals who were arrested. So I'm saying, how do we move the needle to make it equal, where the folks who are black and brown aren't portrayed as the savages,
well,
and those other people
I don't
had
like
bad
to call
behaviors.
People brutes or savages or thugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. People are human beings.
Yeah.
And I like to use those terms, especially the word thug, because it comes from, it has this racial historiography of white British people who use it to slur dark-skinned Indian people. I hate
yep.
that term. I think it's ridiculous and disgusting. But I do believe in what you just said, and grappling all these issues from the same perspective and making sure that I, as a myself as a journalist,
yeah.
I go at it from the same perspective. That's important, too, but it's also important. One of the things I notice in being a journalist mm-hmm. is receiving emails and tweets and whatnot from people challenging me when I am wrong. And that's very important to me. I like to be challenged because I think if you have all the answers all the time, I don't trust you.
Yeah.
I don't trust anything about you. So it's important. If you disagree with the New York Daily Newspaper, I think you mentioned this, let them know. You tweet at them, you Facebook
right.
them, you email them constantly, you even call the damn number and let them know that you don't like it. And
so,
sooner or later, if there's a flood of public
yeah.
discontent,
right.
they have to change. They
stop
have to.
Buying it, though.
Right.
You have to stop buying it.
What if you're not even
buying it?
But what if you're not the one who buys it anyway? That's the question. If
I mean,
you're talking about
all you can do is obviously take action yourself, but with everything in America, it is about money. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. If you want to know what's happening in America, it's about money or resources or control of some sort, which goes back to money or ownership or something, right?
But it's also about instant gratification,
yeah.
Right? So if these stories are not constantly being told in the media, just like you said, that there's a lot of people out there with blogs, there's a lot of people on, you know, you have Black Twitter. So anytime something happens and you go to Black Twitter, something's going to get shut down because so many of us going in, right, that it changes a direction.
Exactly.
The problem is if the story, like you're saying about Ted and Bundy, is not put out there on a consistent basis and people don't feel like they're getting 1,001 retweets, then they stop telling the story. And it's not about that. You have to pick up momentum. You just have to keep with the grind because it'll be one story that'll hit that now you have 1,000,000 retweets.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, like you said, it is connected to money. If people don't see that there's a value at the end of it, they stop.
Okay, and just so everybody knows, those retweets, that's somebody's money. That's their brand.
That's
leading you to their website to click on a link. That's leading you to a Facebook page that they're selling advertising against, right? All of that all goes back to money.
So we're going to open it up to the young people, but an interesting statistic that I came across today, 1,500 newspapers in America, 1,100 magazines, 9,000 radio stations, and 1,500 TV stations. If you mash them all together, they're owned by about 6 corporations. So if you vote with your dollars, you vote with your tweets, you only have to contact really 6 people.
Right.
It's doable.
Right.
All right. Kenneth, we're starting with you. Keep us honest.
Hello?
Hi.
This is for Ebro. I like what you said about when people, if they stop shooting the things, because when fights and stuff happen with teens today, it's like we're the ones pulling out the phones. You see what I'm saying? These fights, I'm pretty sure, happen in like suburban areas and stuff, but people are not pulling out the phones and like putting on WorldStar. So that's a problem in itself. So, if it be that one person to stand out and be like, hey, this is wrong, we got to stop jumping this person, then I think that will change something. Money is a huge thing with the businesses and stuff because they control like Twitter and Facebook and all those things. So this is put out like as a mass media thing because every time a little thing happened with Black people, it's blown up because these are publications and stuff that are owned by white people that been like racist for years, so they capitalize on that, you know? And we need like to create our own like big publications so we can see the true stories that's happening, because it's easy to paint someone as a thug, especially when you're not living in the life, you're not living in that neighborhood, so you don't know what's happening. These kids are like, half of the time that happened, these kids are hungry, these kids are starving, these kids are angry from the life that they have, so they react that way. It's not so much of them being a thug or them being angry, it's life situations and they reacting like that, or they have that mentality. So
all right, thank you, Kenneth. So before we even go any further, we've had a lot of discussion about the racist nature of a lot of the mass media. So I want to know from you, Mr. Media person sitting here, what would make a person who is not of color not tune out right now? If everything leads back to this is the white people own the media and they're depicting Black people like this because we pulled out our phone and recorded it, how do we bridge that gap to make it an inclusive thing to say, you know, you're doing something bad? How do you not lose a coalition to make change happen by saying what you believe to be true?
You mean about how white folks own the media?
Yeah. What's going to change if we have young people who can recognize that, you know what, white people control the media and we make these videos, we click on these things because that's all they feed us. So how do we move forward from there if the line is so thick and drawn?
Oh, that's a very heavy question.
You're in the media as well. If you have a ready answer, I'll listen.
There's other things being fed out there. Oprah put up a network, right? That none of us supported.
She put up a network. Yeah, none of us supported it. We didn't watch it. Right? There might be, you might have watched it, or but not enough of us. Empire jumped on Fox. Empire jumped on Fox. We watched it. And so Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, which also owns The Daily News.
Yeah.
No, he owns
or the Post, excuse me.
And Fox News.
Is now they're going to make more programming catered to black people because they see our behavior, right? But once again, it's on us.
It's perpetuating the stereotypical things of black people. It's not like really
listen.
What black people are.
No, but people watch it though. My point is we're watching the program. We have to take some responsibility for the things we consume. And they'll stop being made.
Well, okay. Before, I know that I put this to you first, but I definitely don't want to lose the voice of you guys. Do you have something in this stream that you want to contribute, Crystal, Aisha? Okay, I'm going to give it back to these two.
Maybe something will come up.
Something will come up. Well, I was just going to say, black people are 13 or 12.5% of the population. Mm-hmm. Our Latino brothers and sisters are
18 or 20.
It's like 14%, almost 14% of the population. This is still a majority white country. No matter where we go, we're going to enter corporations and stores, and we're going to watch media that is owned by white people who don't have our interests at heart. Mm-hmm. As far as like what we can do as black and brown people, as minoritized people, when it comes to this battle, it's easy to say, like, we shouldn't watch World Star Hip Hop, which is owned by black people. We shouldn't watch some of these shows that perpetuate black stereotypes. Why can't we be human, too? You know what I mean? Like, black people are human. We have the same sort of inhibitions or the same sort of cravings that a lot of other people do. Brown people do the same thing. Right. It's a ridiculous onus to place on black and brown and other minoritized people, which is that you should just stop being human like this. No, we're human too, and sometimes we're going to screw up, and sometimes we're going to watch things that we shouldn't watch, or we're going to listen to things that we shouldn't listen to. The onus is not on us.
Yeah.
The onus is on, like, this white supremacist, anti-black, anti-brown society in which we live.
All right, Aisha, you have something for me? Anything you've been keeping track of that you want to unpack a little?
Can you hear me?
Keep talking. They're working very hard up there.
I wanted to direct this statement to the principal, Nadi Lopez.
Yeah.
In my school, you said something about if the safety agents, if they disrespect the students, that you address it. And I just wanted to say, like, what if that didn't apply for the other public schools in New York City? Because in my school, if the safety agent disrespects you and you reply, you get suspended.
Right.
So, like, what would be your thing to say to the other principals that are not like you?
Mm. So, that's real.
Yeah, it's real, right? That's real. So I can't be accountable for every principal in New York City. Unfortunately, there's 1,700 schools. And everyone has a different philosophy. I don't have that mentality. Everyone knows who deals with me. Marlon comes to my school. Brian has dealt with my school. It's like it's the children first, right? But there's also, if a child is disrespectful to a safety agent, they're not going to get away with that either. Everyone has to come to the table. I literally have a table. Everyone has to come to that table. We're going to have a conversation. I don't make assumptions. I'm not going to do that. I don't deal with he say, she say. We're all grown. We need to all come to the table because I just need to understand why would you have a conversation with a child that would make them feel disrespected? Because that goes back to being hurt. I want this scholar to know that I'm their advocate. When that parent isn't in the building, I'm their parent. By New York State law, a child is in the building. We are their parents. We have to protect them. Anything happens, it's on my watch. So I need to sit there and I need to hear what's going on because if my scholar is wrong, then we need to address that. But if the adult is wrong, then we need to hold you accountable. And that's point blank, period. And that goes across in any job. That doesn't have to be just because it's a safety agent in a school. We should always be respected in the spaces that we're in. So I don't know if you have a student government, if you have perhaps a guidance counselor or assistant principal, some adult that you can speak to, maybe a teacher who would be willing to listen and be your advocate. But if you get enough of your peers, and I would say start with 5, start with 10,
you have so much power that you have no idea, okay? You start with a petition. You write out, like, y'all learn claims, right? And you have to have your supporting evidence. Here's the claim. Here's the supporting evidence. All of these children here who have signed this petition, we're speaking out against the injustices that's happening in our building. And we need to have a meeting. Do the very thing that they've taught you to do, right? Have a claim, because that's Common Core. Get your supporting evidence and present it.
Yes.
Do you know any alternatives to suspensions?
That's me all day. So I never get to my job until, like, I'm here early. I'm never out of my building before 6 or 7 o'clock. My daughter's in the audience, because I don't get to my real work until after 6 o'clock, when every scholar is gone. Because I end up talking more to children, and I end up talking to their parents, because I believe in post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I believe that a lot of our children are dealing with abandonment. They're dealing with the stress of being a parent to their parents, or being a parent to their siblings. Some of my parents can't even manage themselves, let alone manage the children that they have in their lives. So if I'm not, like, if you come into my office, there's literally these little couch chairs, and I just sit and I give people the space to talk. And sometimes that just changes the whole momentum of what's going on. Like, people come in angry, children come in, I had a scholar who would come in angry and upset. And as soon as he walked in, the first thing a teacher said was, "Why are you in here late?" And he stormed out and he started cursing. By the time I got to him, I said, "Just don't say anything else. Just don't say anything else. Just go in my office. Just sit." I wait. I don't even follow him. I let him sit. Give him a minute. I sat down. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Yesterday, I was pulled over by a detective. They wanted to say that I had something to do with a shooting. This morning, I was coming here, but I was a little late. They threw my book bag on the ground. And then I got in the truant officer's car, and I get over here. And the first thing he's going to say to me is, 'Why am I late?'" We weren't listening. The first thing he should have said is, "Good morning, scholar. As soon as I have an opportunity, I'll talk to you later and find out what happened." So because I sat down with them, the first thing I did was I called the sergeant of the 73rd precinct, and I asked her to come over, because somebody needs to apologize to him. And we need to have a conversation about who this person was who treated him the wrong way. Then I called the council member, and I was like, "This is unacceptable. We need to have a conversation about when we can have all of us at the table together to make sure that he doesn't feel this way." So instead of suspending him, because someone else would have said he needs to be suspended, I'm not suspending him because he was angry at the situation that came to be. You could suspend kids. Don't get me wrong. Kids have gotten suspended. But it takes a lot. I'm not going to suspend a child who just needs sometimes someone to listen to them first.
All right. Now it's time for us to listen to you, Crystal.
It's on, right?
It's on.
Okay, all right. So I wanted to go back to what Marlon said. He was saying that, talking about how whenever anyone gets in trouble, and this can be anywhere, like in school, in any place, you get in trouble, you make a mistake, we throw you out. We don't want to deal with you, we don't ask what's wrong, what's happening, which is exactly what Mrs. Lopez is talking about right now. So I always talk about this with my friends, because I feel like that's something that you don't see often in my school. I feel like it's a very open environment, and if you need help, you will get the help. Like, and I feel very blessed to be in a school that way. And I feel like one of the key reasons why the school is that way is because, one, we have a very good support system, like in advisories, and two, we have teachers who are willing to talk to us about anything, like things that are happening right now. So for instance, everyone has an advisor, and even if you don't have an advisor, like I feel confident saying that almost, or like everyone in there has someone they can go to and be like, "I need to talk about this because this is affecting me." Mm-hmm. Two, we have classes that we can take in my school, like even in just history class, but like specifically we have a sociology class. In that class, you talk about, sociology is a study of society. So you talk about everything having to do with the world we live in, gender, race and all those kinds of things. And I feel like it's essential for people to understand, like, and like live in the world we live in. You get it? Because what I feel like is that the school system focuses way too much on testing, mm-hmm. and all they care about is like.
I'm looking at a bunch of young people who are clapping their hands, just for those of you listening on the radio, they concur.
Yeah, I feel like it's like they jam-pack the curriculum, and it's like, yeah, that's important to talk about. We don't have time to talk about it because you have to pass this, because I have to look good for the system, and you have to get somewhere. And it's like, you're not giving me time. You're not letting me learn what's important. Like, I'm sorry, but I don't think that knowing why a drape is blue in a literary book is important. I feel like, why?
Your people are here tonight, Crystal. You are talking to those students.
I feel like what would be important is like, why am I here? Why am I a minority? Why do I have to struggle? Why do I live in a neighborhood that used to be full of my people and everything, and now we're full of like, these different, like, all my people are getting kicked out is what I'm saying. Like, gentrification, like, why is this happening?
So, I just want to jump in real quick. So, this young, what's your name, sis?
Crystal,
I'm sorry, Crystal. I usually don't remember names, so expect that from me. In her comments, right, she spoke about issues that we tend not to go to young people about, right? Mm-hmm. Now, she spoke about, she didn't speak just about education, but she spoke about the system of education in terms of what she's being taught in schools and what's important over what's not important. She spoke about gentrification, right? We don't think young people know what's going on. They may not always use the word gentrification as something they might just understand as white people moving in the neighborhood. Right? Or why we getting evicted out of our project building, right? But they know, they're conscious of it, right? And I think that we just, it's very difficult, I guess, for adults, because we have our own trauma issues that we're dealing with.
Of course.
We want significance. We want to be important. We've had our own issues of being quieted in many cases. So when we get the opportunity, we just act like we block everything else out. But we're missing that they are conscious of what's happening around them. They're not only conscious of that somebody on a block got shot. They're only conscious of somebody, you know, not only conscious of that, they're conscious of the largest social systems. That illustrate, that result in those issues that we put on the news. They're conscious of all those things at the underroots. And I think it's just sensible. Is it not sensible for us to like pay attention, and not only pay attention in a sort of, in a way that's patronizing, but in a way that they actually get to inform us about what needs to be done, and so also identify what's wrong in the spaces that they live in.
Dowry.
So I wanted to bring it back to when we were talking about like the medium, mm-hmm. and then another big thing that came up was Ms. Lopez was talking about how the way that the media like perpetuates us, and then I was thinking about this because I was working on a project about how the media sells us our identity. So then what came into mind was that we watch like the media, and then we get like the media is something that's big around nowadays, and we all have iPhones, we all have computers and all this stuff. So it's something that's all around us. So whatever they're selling us is clearly gonna influence our minds. And so if like how you guys were saying that they were calling the women in McDonald's like the brutes and then the thugs, and then if they keep saying this to us, this is all that we're gonna know. And this is all that we're gonna like think about them, because the thing about the media is that sometimes, like, let's say I live in this neighborhood and I'm not like from Flatbush, and then I don't know what's going on in Flatbush. The only way, like my only source of me knowing what's going on in Flatbush is by going on to like the Daily News or going on to these like big sources that's telling me what's going on there, and I'm gonna take that as like a credible source. So then these people are like giving us our identity. So then, and then we're not being, like we're being perpetuated as being like those thugs and being like those minorities and always fighting. Cause that's all you're seeing nowadays too, and in the news about those crime rates and the Bronx and killings and all this stuff. And it's usually like people like us, like the Latin community and the blacks too, like the black community and how we're minorities and always killing other people. So then like this perpetuation is spreading to everywhere, and then everybody's just getting the sense of how we are. And it's always like that blabbering about how bad we are and all these things that's going on. So then it's like changing their perception.
So, you know what I have to ask then, Dowry, Aisha, Crystal, Kenneth, who lied on you? Mm-hmm. Who presented an image of you that you want to demolish right now, never to be heard of again?
Something I always talk about is how... So I turned 17 in July. So last year when I turned 16, I remember thinking like, oh, I don't want to be that age, because like that's the age everyone criticizes. Like when you hear any 16-year-old, you're like, oh, they're a thug. Like they don't care. They just do stupid things, yeah, and they're idiots and whatever. And it does not represent who I am. I'm actually responsible. I care about my school. I want to be something someday. Like, I just don't like that my age automatically lets someone know who I am when none of it is true. Like, it's just a big thing. And then especially, I don't know, I just hate it. And it's just...
All right, no more getting down on 16-year-olds. You heard it here, she quashed it. I'm going to you, yeah.
Really quick, I just wanted to give another example.
Please.
I have this friend of mine who's Asian, right? And then he does a lot of studying. He's like... he's a smart kid in my class, right?
Yeah.
So then every time, like, we have those PSAT tests, those regions.
Everyone wants to sit next to your Asian friend.
And then he's always talking about, like, I'm thinking about, I want to go to this cool, this good college and everything, those prestigious colleges. But then he's always bringing up the statistics as if those statistics define me. Mm-hmm. So then it's like how they're selling me this identity, but do they really know who I am?
Yep. So, in terms of just thinking about when you said the branding piece of it and how the stereotypes are perpetuated. So after I was just so upset that I felt like enough was enough with the last article. It was in the New York magazine. I was livid, right? So I was like, I had already said it out loud. I was already working on this. I was like, I'm going to create my own magazine. That's it. I woke up. It was January of 2014. I called my girlfriend, Sarita Gates, who's like phenomenal. I said, Sarita, I need to create a magazine. And she was just like, really, at midnight? This and she was like, can you call me back? So I called at 6 a.m. So that thought, that idea, because I'm relentless when I have an idea. And I said, I need my scholars to create a magazine, but I want them to understand the complexity of how to develop a magazine. I want them to know who, like the creative director, I want them to know the roles and responsibilities. It's not just gonna be, we're gonna put something out. It's gonna be a life skill that they're gonna walk away with. So I don't have any money, but I found something. And I said, even if you do it pro bono, we just pay materials, whatever it is, I'll print the magazines out of my own pocket, whatever it's gonna take. She said, I'm with it. We got people from Brownsville. Made in Brownsville came out and supported us and did the digital layout and everything. Mm. My custodians let us stay in the building till midnight, 1 o'clock sometimes, just to get it pushed through. And the reason why I did that is because I wanted my scholars to see that in order for you to change the narrative, you have to control your content. Mm-hmm. And we keep asking people permission. So a lot of the things that I'm hearing is there's all of these things that don't speak to us, but when are we going to start controlling and saying we're going to start speaking of us, right? And I have a middle school, and I don't feel like middle schoolers are any less significant than high schoolers, but I have to start teaching them now. So we created it, and I said the reason why we're doing a digital magazine that will print some out is because really all of the magazines are online and things are folding. So I'm going to even teach them why they need to have a digital magazine. Mm. So if you go online and you Google it, it's under ISU Brownsville Brilliance, and it's 60 pages because I said there's going to be content that speaks to the brilliance of this community. So they wrote the articles themselves. We found pictures. We took pictures, and they published it. And then we're doing another one that She Is Me. But what I'm going to say to you young people, you have to start advocating and mobilizing. Yep. People only respect you when you come with an idea. You can't, you know, sometimes you're emotional and your emotions, even adults, it sounds like you're yelling. Find one person. There has to be one person in the building. One who you have to be able to say, I need to talk to you. I have a really great idea. Let that person be the one who's going to speak to the principal, the assistant principal, whoever. Because in high school, there's multiple assistant principals. Someone's going to speak to the principal because you don't often have the opportunity to speak to them yourselves. But you have to start changing their mindset. Because oftentimes, I'm going to be honest, some adults in buildings should not be in buildings. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to lead. They don't know 21st century. So we talk about all these great things, and they're still stuck in 1978. And that's not where we're going. So you have to bring them, and they appreciate that. But you have to find one person. Mm-hmm. That's going to help you through it.
Yuritsa, I know that she's speaking your language now. We're talking about organizing.
It's organizing right on the local level, which is important. You can't just jump into citywide organizing, right? You can't in the larger levels. You got to be organizing locally, right? You got to be organizing.